Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to HealthyLife.net Positive Talk Radio. This is Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to Health Freedom Now. Today, we are going to talk about saving money on medical care. But first, I have to give a shout-out to a colleague that was suddenly taken away from us too soon. Marshall Allen was a journalist who investigated why we pay so much for our medical care in the United States, and sometimes get very little in return. He was the author of one of the best books I have read on this topic, and listen to the title well, Never Pay the First Bill and Other Ways to Fight the Healthcare System and Win. And that's exactly what the book is. It tells you just what to do. It's a complete roadmap. Marshall Allen had founded the Allen Health Academy, and he had a curriculum and little videos that told you exactly what to do, and he still has that website up, about saving money on your health care bills. Interestingly, this was all pushed by his love for people. Before he was an investigative journalist, he spent 5 years in full-time ministry, including 3 years in Nairobi in Kenya. And he has a master's degree in theology. In his own words, let me say what Marshall said about his mission on lowering health costs. I've spent more than 15 years investigating the healthcare industry as a journalist, exposing the insidious ways the system preys on vulnerable Americans, price gouging, sloppy billing, fraud insurance denials, unnecessary treatment, and more. I wish I could say it all, but I haven't. It sours me when I hear about people getting beaten down by the system. It's become my personal mission to help individuals and employers understand the healthcare system and show how they can overcome the bullying and win. People who push back are getting great healthcare at a much lower cost. I love highlighting real-life examples of these victories so everyone can see how it's done. Marshall Allen, rest in peace. We know something is wrong with our healthcare system. I have a guest today, Matt Ort, who's another innovator in reducing costs without government intervention. Matt, while he was working at Merrill Steel in Wisconsin, led the company on a healthcare transformation journey. That's about the only way to put it. He started multiple healthcare services at no cost to the employees and their families. He had on-site clinics, a mobile clinic, physical therapy, MRIs, and multiple surgeries, and a wellness program. He has written a wonderful book called Save Your Company, Don't Feed the Beast: The Employer Healthcare Success Formula. Welcome to the show, Matt Ort.
Thank you, Marilyn. Good morning. It's great to be with you today.
Well, we are so glad to hear from you, but I have to ask you, one of the things that just really pulled me into your book was how you opened it. You told us about an accident you have. Can you tell everybody about it?
Yeah, it certainly impacted my journey on healthcare firsthand. You know, and by the way, a quick mention of Marshall. He was a friend of mine and a colleague, and he and I shared a couple of commonalities, one of faith and also of primary passion to help people. So just wanted to mention that he was actually going to speak at my conference at the end of August, and then and just all sorts of surprises. So I wish the best for he and his family, but he certainly made his splash in the healthcare market. Yeah, the intro, so this was somewhat of a late addition to my book. It certainly impacted my healthcare journey and my leadership from the inside as a VP of HR for a large steel company. But it gave me a firsthand personal experience in kind of a bad way. So I had an accident. I always kind of joke that I got into healthcare by accident, literally. But I was working in my backyard, which I live on the Wisconsin River, which is a big river, about 300 feet wide. So you can kind of imagine the intimidating presence of that. And I have a bluff that kind of overlooks it. It's been dug out now, but it went down. I measured it. It was around 42 feet down and not really a hill, more of a bluff, almost really not even walkable unless you're grabbing onto branches and things. But I was digging that out, going to dig that out, and I was pulling up trees with a tractor that I had had. And one of the things that people misunderstand is they think I was on the tractor and it rolled. That was not the case. I was not on the tractor. It was parked up on a flat, and I had a chain that was kind of hanging over the bluff, and I would kind of scale down and hook up a tree, a dead tree, and there were about four of them, and I was going to pull it up. And pretty straightforward. I pulled up the first three without incident with less than an hour and was hooking up the fourth tree, and get on the tractor, and it would spin. It just couldn't get leverage. And then one more time, change position, spin, and I was on my third time. I was pretty confident this was going to work. I had a better angle. And then the unexpected happened. So I it was a restored tractor, so in good condition. But just as I was hooking up the chain and about to kind of crawl up and jump on the tractor, I heard a pop, and that was the parking brake coming loose, and I still to this day don't know why or how that happened, but it set the course of events that would kind of forever change my life and life experiences. So then as I kind of scaled up, I think I was in my late 40s, I'm 50, just about 51, but my late 40s at the time, pretty fast, and I, without getting, you know, there's a lot of detail, I went down one morning to write this as the intro of my book, and I thought it would be a page or two. It ended up being about something like 12 to 14 pages, so I just kind of kept writing. But before I knew it, as I was attempting to kind of just put my hand on the big wheel to stop this little bit of momentum, which is very possible, it must have hit a dip in the ground, took off, kind of jumped at me, if you will, caught my steel-toed boot underneath it, and it seemed like about a nanosecond, I was now under this tractor, missing the drawbar, which sticks out of the back, which is what you hook up wagons to. And it was rolling backward down this bluff, and I was kind of rolling, and it rolled directly over me. The tire tracks from the big ribs of the rear tires over my chest would show up about 3 days later, the bruising. And ended up with my feet almost kind of just touching the water somehow, and then watching the tractor roll into the, you know, the rest of the way, roll into the river and go under. And from there set course with some events of going to ER and having some fraudulent billing experiences and a whole host of things that really just fueled my fire to fix healthcare. And really at that time my thought was just for that employer. Of course it expanded now to a statewide leadership movement and even a national front where I'm now wrote the book and speaking in 17 cities this year in the first 10 months. So it's certainly nothing I planned, but of course, God has plans. We have our plans, and God has His plans, and here I go. But my quest is to help people and to help employers now fix their health care.
When I think about that, all I can do is see this visual of a man pinned under a tractor wondering, how am I going to pay for this? Not am I going to live, but how am I going to pay for this? And believe me, many people are thinking the same thing. And when they ought to be thinking about something else, what's my family going to do? What are my kids? What's going to happen to my kids? But no, they're thinking, how am I going to pay for this? So we all know that so many people get their health insurance from their employer. So this is a good place to start. We have so many avenues that we have to run up to try to change some of the problems we have in the states. So your focus has been on employers. And so tell us what you did at the first company and what was happening that made you think it even needed to change.
Yeah, so in 60 to 70, I think it's 70% nationally, something like 65% in Wisconsin, are what they call self-insured or self-funded, meaning the employer's covering most of the cost out of their pocket, and then they have some insurance on the top. So this is a primary market. This isn't a small market. This is actually the majority, if you will, of employers across the nation and employees and their families. I showed up in 2016 as the VP of HR, and the owners had expressed to me, they said, you know, we've been absorbing all these increases. A lot of times, right, they'll pass them on, 80-20, et cetera. They said, we've been absorbing it, but we can't keep doing that because we've had an average, 9% increases the last 5 years in a row. And it doesn't maybe sound like a lot, but when you're talking about over a $5 million spend, that's a pretty big number every year. And so they said, is there anything we can do about this? We know you're a problem solver. You've got a history of kind of leading positive change. And interestingly, at the time, I mean, this is kind of the way I think most HR folks still think. We call it benefits inside, and you can divide it into parts. But I didn't think it was very exciting. I thought it was kind of boring, and you kind of get through it and move on. And I think that's what most still do. But here we're talking about the second or third largest business expense. And so when we gain the right perspective, my first question was, how do I fix this? What do I do, right? So I had a lot of learning. I knew the game that insurance had handed us. I knew about premiums. I know about deductibles. I know about networks and all this game that is a winner for the seller and a loser for the buyer for the last 30-ish years. And so I said, how can I win at this game? I'm pretty good at figuring stuff out and so forth. Worked at Toyota way back and learned about root cause, problem solving, and all these tools. And I came to the conclusion that there's no way to win in the insurance-led game. That the game is designed for you to lose. The game is designed for insurance to win. In fact, they can never lose because their boat always floats, and they want the prices to go up, contrary to most people's thinking, per an ACA MLR law that I won't get into. But they get to keep 15% of the premiums. And so 15% of a bigger number is certainly more than 15% of a smaller number. So people don't realize that insurance, both the sellers on that side and even the brokers are compensated through commission. Brokers, the insurance, and hospitals all want the prices to go up, and that's to the detriment of employers and employees and their families. So we realized that we were going to have to get out of that box. We were going to have to maybe look at a new game, or at least an adjusted game if we're going to win at this.
What I find interesting is the idea, and people are thinking, what? They want the prices to go up. And, you know, you were very careful to say it's the prices, it's the premiums. Of course, they don't want the actual costs they have to pay out to go up. But, of course, as the prices go up, they'll go up everywhere. The gauze pad's going to cost more. Just your simple dressing change suddenly isn't free like it used to be in the old days. Now they make sure they charge for every single Band-Aid, every single anything. And this is one of the things when you talk about the fraudulent billing. So many times people are billed for things that they didn't even have. And people are divorced from that to some degree because the employer is the first person that's dealing with the insurance company. And it just bothers me that we've gotten so far away from realizing what the true cost of something is versus the price that Mr. X is paying, Mr. Y is paying, because sometimes it's not the person who's receiving the care. But eventually, they get hit, deductibles and co-pays, and then they realize, oh, this is really getting to me. So what have you done to get employers to look at this in a way where they've got to save money starting at the top?
one of the things I realized through various things was that not only was healthcare off the radar within companies, but that the industry had done a good job to their benefit, but to the buyer's detriment of monopolizing the market. So the power we have as buyers, I jokingly called it payer power. When I realized that I had payer power, I began to think in a free market economics way instead of the monopoly way that is currently set up. If we look at a simple example, and you could take anything, the way we shop for everything, cars, TVs, et cetera, I like to use a restaurant example. If a restaurant opens up and they, right there, they have to attract customers based on service, based on quality, based on locality, based on price, right? We all know this game really well. We play it unconsciously every day. And if they fail at one of those in enough of a way or a level that they could lose customers if their prices are too high or their service is bad or their food's cold or doesn't taste good, the customer has the power. The payer says, I'm going to patronize you, but I have many other options. If I don't like your deal, I'll walk away and I'll go somewhere else. And so as the industry has monopolized this market through a disguised word of network, even a network that we sign away our ability to shop voluntarily and say, I'm getting a 40% off deal. And then we beg the question, 40% off of what? Well, the charge master, but that's a gag clause and we can't share the prices. So we don't even know unit price. We know unit price and everything else we buy before we buy it, not 3 months after when we get the bill. And this thing about, well, just looking at what the insurance card covers, right, is a no-win game as well, because this year's premiums are next year's, this year's plan costs, rather, or this year's claims costs are next year's premiums. And so leading up to that, then, we have to have a free market approach. We have to create an environment in healthcare where we shop for healthcare services, not for insurance necessarily, by the way, another trick of the trade. We have to shop for healthcare services. That's what we're purchasing. We don't need to pay these middlemen 50 to 75% of the total cost to add no value, zero value in the middle. So as we start to look at the free market, we realize that now there were 15 of these doctors that break away because they're just as frustrated with these 7-minute visits, this rushed care that they're forced to do in primary care. In Wisconsin, for instance, there were 15 of these in 2020 in a Madison article. Guess how many there are today? 124. That's how many total clinics we have just to provide direct primary care. Direct as in avoid the insurance game. And then we have what we call direct specialty care. These are just independents. These are free market medical practices that want to give you the best quality, the best care at the best price. And so we open that up as another option. We still have the hospital there. Even in our plan, we still have the hospital there. But if the plan pays more, you're going to pay more. You're going to pay your old deductible. But then on the plan, we say all these other options are so much less. We can get an MRI for $600 instead of $6,000 to $10,000. We can get a hip or knee replacement for $20,000 instead of $100,000. And these just crazy numbers. And so as we start to shop, we can actually give that to the plan member for free. And they kind of look at you funny, right? You say, you can give me an MRI for free? Yeah, because the plan would rather pay 100% of $600 than 80% of $6,000. You don't have to be great at math, right, to do that. They say 70% of people are great at math and 40% aren't. So I don't know where I fall in that. But, right? So as we just do some basic economics and basic math, we can learn to shop for healthcare really well.
That your statistics is kind of like, I guess it was supposed to be Yogi Berra, 98% of the game is half mental.
That's right. Love it.
Well, the thing that is interesting to me, you know, when you're saying this, I was thinking about something I had read recently about Medicare. This, and people would be surprised to know this, Medicare pays for some over-the-counter drugs, but it costs more if Medicare pays for it than if you just went ahead and paid for it yourself. And these are even simple things like ibuprofen. If you buy Walgreens' own brand or Kroger's own brand or whatever, you can afford that. That's just a couple of dollars. And if you ever look at these insurance bills, you realize a big point you made. There's a difference in the price versus buying a service. That, for example, my husband got a bill from Medicare, and it the service, well, I can't even remember what it was, EKG or something. It wasn't even something that big. It was like $600, but Medicare approved is $127. How can there be that big of a discrepancy? So you think, okay, it's actually really worth $127 and probably worth even less than that if you weren't going through a middleman.
Exactly. There used to be a show called Mythbusters. I don't think that show's on anymore, if you've ever heard of that show. That this should be on that show, right? So that we're led to believe that big insurance can give us a better deal because of their power and numbers negotiating. They probably could if they really wanted to, but the interesting thing is almost often, you know, very often, the insurance price is not at all the lowest price, because they, in the pharmacy side, they do what's called spread pricing. They're paying the pharmacy less than what they're actually charging, so they're getting an additional charge there. So they're skimming off the top in about, you know, all these undiscernible ways that we don't see. So we have to pick partners that are trustworthy. We have to pick partners and PBMs and TPAs and these self-funded health plan partners that are on our side. And when they start playing games, we can get tricked. Even the gag clauses, I always say, why would you pay a lawyer to remove the gag clauses from a healthcare partner that's not working with you, that's trying to keep your own claims data from you, their own secrets, so they can trick you better? Why don't you find a trustworthy partner that doesn't have it? So I'm big on the trustworthy partners. That's a whole chapter in my book.
Well, and I think that's important, because as patients, we need to be trustworthy partners. And after the break, we're going to talk. You say something in the book about where you call it sick care, not health care. And this is something we on this network are looking for, real health care, not sick care. So we'll get into that after the break.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does, especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at AutismSpeaks.org, brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Faucet running? That's not a faucet. That's a river rushing through the forest. Forest rivers provide over 100 million people with clean water to drink.
What? I can't hear you because of the vacuum.
That's not a vacuum. That's the trees in the forest cleaning up the air we breathe.
I didn't know the trees were so amazing.
Yep, and the forest gives us shade, trees to climb.
That's awesome. Let's go explore some more.
Visit the forest today and enjoy all it does, just for you. To learn more about the forest and find one near you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
This is a book every woman needs to put into their home library. Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, MD, covers the entire range of women's health from the first menstrual period through menopause and everything in between. This fully updated version includes the very latest treatment and research data combining new technologies with natural remedies and the miraculous healing powers within the body itself. It's one of the best medical reference books on women's health, and you can get Women's Body, Women's Wisdom by Christiane Northrup, MD at Amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Sterling, and I know what it's like to struggle with mental health issues. If you have a friend that's going through a tough time, now's the perfect moment to reach out. Learn how to start the conversation at seizetheawkward.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and the Jed Foundation.
Uplifting Talk, HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, I brought up the idea that you had brought up in your book, and many of us here on the network are thinking about it. Our current system is sick care, not health care. There doesn't seem to be a focus on people keeping themselves well. What are some of the things you can do, starting at the employer level, to kind of change that mentality?
Yeah, I think a couple of things come to mind, Marilyn, one of the things we did is that we were big enough to have an on-site direct primary care clinic Now, it doesn't have to be on site. These are what's called the DPCs I spoke of, where there's 124 now just in the state of Wisconsin. It can also be near site. So it was open to the employees and their families. And so this allowed us really having this DPC availability, which the trend is growing pretty fast, allowed us to do a lot of things. One, we had the employees go there for their physicals, for their drug screens. So we got them very familiar with the clinic and comfortable even before they were hired. And then we developed the best wellness program that we could. So we incentivized them greatly, and we had 90%+ of our employees and their family members going through this clinic, just getting them exposed and doing coaching and doing kind of annual physicals and things like that and some other fun activities like the walking tracker games and contests and things like that. So I think getting people educated, there is a challenge, I'll tell you, right? The joke is, you say, I became responsible for wellness, and I said, oh, that'll be easy. All I have to do is to get people to care about their own health. And then I said, oh, no, all I have to do is to get people to care about their own health. And so I think we can all relate. We have some very nice cheese curds in Wisconsin, which I try to practice moderation there, no more than once per day. Just kidding. But I think when we're encouraged and we have cheerleaders, right, in the clinic, and we have a primary care physician that actually can coach us and joke with us and walk around the business sometimes, that's a big deal. And so I think a lot of times we're not aware. Did you realize this food's really bad for you? This food's really good for you? And people do start to kind of follow that lead.
It's so interesting to me, and a lot of people think, and like how you began, oh, just get people to work on their own health care. When you're barraged on television and even on the radio with these pharmaceutical ads, that get people in the mindset that you have a problem, pop a pill. Yet you read the medical literature and more they're saying things like exercise, sunshine, and fresh air, the real basics, they prevent things up to dementia, obviously not completely prevent it, but they look at risk factors. And these are some of the things that improve your odds of not getting sick with multiple things. Yet we don't hear that on television. All we hear are drugs, drugs, and more drugs. So I think this idea of having physician coaches and a whole system that's trying to help people get well is so important.
It really is, and I think it takes the partners with the similar thinking, right? A lot of times the solutions are really going back to very old-fashioned ways, which worked really well. My grandparents ate out of their garden. They didn't have all these, you know, preservatives in their foods. And, a couple of things. I think the food industry, right, which is motivated by money, certainly, and the drug industry, which is motivated by money. We don't have a headache because we have a lack of aspirin in our system, and that would be a very low-level thing. But sometimes if I have this mentality that a drug just fixes it for me, well, then I need a drug to counteract the side effects of those symptoms and another drug to counteract the side effects. And pretty soon I'm on 4 or 5 medications, which are very nice recurring income for the PBMs, especially in the pharmacy industry. And then just going back to natural food coaching, right? I mean, I've seen cases, and this is a whole nother episodes, but where the foods today are just so unhealthy for us. And even a lack of protein diet, for instance, causes dementia. Our brain needs proteins, and I won't even pretend to be the medical side here, which you could probably jump in. But I have seen, heard quite a few podcasts and read quite a bit about just when you start messing with all these things that were very natural and healthy before, sometimes these effects don't show up. These side effects of drugs are very unknown. 10 years later, 20 years later, I've seen people getting the shakes and all sorts of side effects because they were on these long-term medications. So to me, that's pretty scary, and I'm personally, I'm going to encourage others to keep it simple, and I'm going to do the same.
It's very interesting, and I've had folks on the show talking about drugs and how many unnecessary medications are kind of really pushed on us. And there's whole programs, and I'm sure this exists in your wellness program, where you actually do this bit by bit, stripping people of drugs they're on to see if they really need it. Obviously, some people must have whatever medication it is they're on. But, you know, it got to be a joke with statins. Oh, so-and-so had a new baby. Pull out the statins. And, you know, it's supposed to be the cure-all for everything. And then year after year, we find one more thing that, maybe not so good. Maybe not so good. And this whole idea of wellness training and something that's in the employer's hands can be really useful for patients, because I think most people think, I'm only going to go to the doctor if I'm sick. But that's not how we have to think about it. We need some sort of system like you have, because if somebody is not getting charged for it, I think they're more likely to use it, because I would think, there's nothing really wrong with me. I don't want to pay, you know, $40 or whatever the copay or what might be, just to have somebody tell me to eat right, even though that's what I need. So this system, I just think, has such advantages. And I've had folks on talking about direct primary care, but explain direct primary care just a bit for this topic.
Yeah, you bring up a great topic, and maybe the number one, if you will, at least in my book, about proactive health, and that's a relationship with your primary care physician, because they can serve as coach, as healer, as prescriber, and I think we would all agree there are certainly some cases where prescriptions are helpful, so it's not this anti pharmacy, but it just seems to be this kind of runaway train. But one of the things interesting that maybe some experience or maybe don't fully realize, they still look at these big hospitals or these big insurance companies, and they see these recognizable brands and names, and they still associate trust. And I would ask the listeners to really question that, of whether they're really earning that trust today. And if we look at direct primary care, for instance, why is direct primary care taking off so fast? Why are there an average of 25-plus clinics starting every year in Wisconsin? These are doctors or nurse practitioners or PAs leaving the hospital systems to start their own practice because they're frustrated. They have patient loads of 2,000-plus, and a direct primary care physician often has a patient load of around 500. When they hit 500, they will hire another one. They can spend 30 to 60 minutes with a patient. They can get them in within a couple of days, usually, instead of this 3 to 6 months we hear. Well, man, if I have to wait 6 months to get in for a primary care, I think I've forgotten about what my ailment is, or I've already been to ER or urgent care. So this accessibility of the physician is really key in this relationship. And, you know, if I gave my mechanic 15 minutes or 10 minutes and said, you're going to get a car every 10 minutes, how many cars do you think that mechanic would fix? Or are they going to look for quick fixes and really, right, not root cause fixes to keep those cars flowing? So I don't think we have a shortage of direct primary care physicians. I think we have a problem in the process of how hospitals now do primary care. It's been basically removed.
Okay. Well, I think that educates a lot of people as to what direct primary care is. And that's something for people to look for if they have to find a new doctor. After the break, we're going to talk some more about this whole thing of how you can develop methods to save money and how the so-called free market strategies actually work and why they work. So we'll get into that after the break.
Keyboard Cat, Hamilton the Pug, and Toast Meets World. These are some of the internet's most beloved pets, and they all have one thing in common. Their stories started in a shelter. Start your story. Adopt a dog or cat today. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Training that pet to play the keyboard, that's optional. Start a story. Adopt a shelter or rescue pet today. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
So what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can run, but you can't drive high. You can run, but you can't.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to mom. I had no idea how hard it would be and what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and ways for me to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics, but also information about the hurdles I was facing. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The Bright Side of Talk. HealthyLife.net.
Before the break, we were talking about direct primary care. And it's just one thing to keep in mind when we talk about so-called free market medicine. And free market, we go back to something we said at the beginning of the show. It's choices, knowing prices, excuse me, before you step in to purchasing the service. And so there's a lot of things we need to look out for. And so, Matt, what are some of the things people can do in sort of a day-to-day way when they're trying to look out for healthcare prices, or I should say medical care prices? Their own health is healthcare. When you have to go to the doctor, it's medical care. So what can people do?
Yeah, I think there are many resources out there. You know, a lot of times a Google search can produce quite a bit. But I think it's just to get out of this mode that we've been, this kind of unconscious culture of healthcare where we automatically go, right, this in-network, we automatically go to the big hospital, which is very inefficient, very expensive. And so if we're in need of care, and I help a lot of friends, they'll ping me and say, you know, this service, and I can send them five or six. So it does depend on the state and the area. We're seeing this rapid increase in independent medical practices in Wisconsin, which make those answers much easier. But it really comes down to shopping beforehand and knowing the price. So if you say, I need an X-ray, or I need an MRI, or I need a shoulder surgery, and et cetera, right? We could look at all sorts of procedures. Even oncology and cardiology today, we have affordable independent practices that can help. Some are even out of state, but of course, if you need heart surgery, you're probably willing to drive or even be flown at full expense, right, for that kind of service. So I think it's a lot of this mindset. And realizing even on the quality side, that's usually the big question next is, well, how in the world can you get a hip replacement for $20,000 when it costs, you know, $60,000 to $100,000? I've heard even $150,000. The prices vary, by the way. They're not set or standardized across hospitals. How in the world could that be better quality? And so that's kind of a long answer. But the short answer is that these independents often more closely track the quality in their hand-picked surgeon versus, the physician or the person that finished last in medical school, right? Doctor. I kind of ruined my own joke there. But, right, so not every doctor is the same. And I'd rather have the person doing the surgery that does five of these a week than that does five of these a year. And so they get very good at them, and they get very efficient. When we don't do something for a while, we get kind of rusty at it. So a lot of it, I think, is as simple as it sounds, as a mindset to say, what options are available, and what is the price before I buy? My goodness. We see a lot of people going out of network and even out of their plan and paying cash, right? Because if my deductible is $5,000 and the MRI is $6,000, well, I'm going to pay $5,000 for that MRI, but I can go down the road and get one for $600. Why would I even use my insurance plan at that point?
And sadly, it's getting harder and harder to find these independent doctors. There's sort of a shift, as you said, a shift is going on where doctors have gotten so disgusted with these big healthcare systems because over the years, 70% of doctors now either have their practice owned by one of these systems or owned by private equity or they work for somebody else. And that's complete opposite to 40 years ago. So there's this trend and, you know, it is like a runaway train. And I think with the problem of having prior authorizations be denied and, you know, when a doctor wants to do something, by the time they decide that they're going to approve it, the patient could be half dead or dead, which has been the case. And Congress has put forth this law where they're changing prior authorization in federal programs. They can't do it for private. But I couldn't believe it when I actually read the bill. They're patting themselves on the back. We're going to improve prior authorization. Well, what did they do? They made an urgent request 72 hours. How is 72 hours urgent? 3 days for something that's urgent? I mean, but then again, that's how the government thinks. And why your strategies really move away from the government and move away from big business.
Well, in our plan, for instance, with these independents, we wash away the need for pre-authorization. I think that's a wasteful practice. And you have a non-medical or at least a lower-level medical person sitting at a desk questioning a physician's judgment. Right, so I agree it has to fit within the plan, but I think all these wasteful things, like if I was trying to create the most inefficient machine that I could possibly think of, I would create exactly the way big insurance does it today and puts that burden on the hospitals, which they're not exactly efficient-minded, but it certainly burdens them big time. And because they have to do it or they don't get paid. So when we just remove it, just like lean. We say in lean manufacturing, which I learned at Toyota, we say which steps are adding value, and which steps aren't adding any value. You just break it down. It's called a job breakdown chart. And you say all these things that aren't adding value, we'll just either remove those or change them, and we'll keep all the stuff that adds value. A lot of times you can eliminate 50 or 75% of a certain task. And so there was some old stuff in ThetaCare in Wisconsin. I know some people who have done that, and they were having great success. But, of course, the powerful, wealthy industry shuts that down. But it is, in my view, by far the most inefficient system and the most wasteful system at our expense that I know of.
One thing people wonder when we talk about seeking out prices and paying for things ourselves, what do you do with the big ICU bill and the big hospital bill? What sort of way to ensure the person doesn't have to sell their house to pay for a hospitalization? What do you do about that?
Those are the most difficult because the emergent needs are the ones we, as I call it, interrupt. We can't interrupt. We can't help the patient, right? Because if there's an emergency, they have to go. We tell them you should go and go right away, right, obviously. But then there are some things you can do after the fact. But once the services are done, you know, you can try to negotiate with a hospital. In our plan, which is a free market plan, we're not doing what some call as a strategy reference-based pricing, which is they send them out about 160% of Medicare on a 400% of Medicare bill, and they ask them to accept it in full. And that's their only real strategy of saving money. They do that for, like, every bill. I don't believe in that. I think it's just playing a game back. But when you're billed five times as much as you should, then I think we do need to be creative, and there's probably some room there and future opportunity for how do we deal with that? How do you deal with that if you were to buy a car and 3 months later you got a bill for 200 grand? You'd know that the bill is exorbitant, but you're already driving the car and you've already bought the car, and they've kind of got you at that point.
And certainly with emergency things, you really are stuck. Not only are you mentally and physically vulnerable if you're in pain or told you're having a heart attack and need to have your coronary arteries ringed out, certainly not thinking about the price at that point. And so this is why, something you mentioned before, why you have to have trusted partners and those trusted partners will team up with hospitals, and sometimes they might not be right next to you, but hopefully in your area, that will give a fair deal, because they all aren't the same. And this is something I know from practicing at multiple hospitals, that they're not the same. Their business offices aren't the same, and they do have different philosophies. So after the break, I'd just like to talk about some more general things with Matt. He's a very wise man, in my opinion, and there's a couple things that he said in his book that will apply to everything, not just healthcare. One about projects and how you get a new project going, and just sort of general life lessons. So I'd like to talk about that for our last segment after the break.
I know you care about your right to health freedom of choice, but we are under constant attack by industry-driven medical mandates. At MAM.org, you can be part of the solution to keep your rights to health freedom. MAM stands for Millions Against Medical Mandates, and your voice is heard and counted. Visit MAM.org, where doctors, lawyers, journalists, researchers, scientists, and people like you come together to keep our health freedom strong. Together, join the millions at MAM.org. That's MAMM.org.
Hey, hon, what you doing with your phone?
Do flowers have best friends?
I don't know.
Hey, look.
Whoa.
Some answers can only be found in nature. Discover the unsearchable. Visit discovertheforest.org to find a trail near you. Brought to you by the United States Forest Service and the Ad Council.
To some, a baby's babbling doesn't mean much, but it does. Especially if there's no babbling at all. Little to no babbling by 12 months or later is just one of the possible signs of autism in children. Learn more at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
You're listening to CHSR Real Radio on the web.
Before the break, I just wanted to pick Matt's brain about some general lessons in trying to get a movement going, trying to get change going, even in your own job. And it doesn't matter what level you are in the job. There's always somebody who you can talk to about how do you get change, how do you communicate with people. And, Matt, you have something in your book where you talked about the six phases of a project. Can you just go through that? I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Change management is something that I've always been passionate about. I'm not sure why, but I studied it in grad school, and it's something that I actually, in my 25-year HR career, I think there's a notion that a lot of HR people, or the majority of HR people, actually avoid change because it's scary and things could go wrong and they could get in trouble. But I never really viewed it as much as that, is that if you have a problem in front of you, and you fix it, it's going to require leading people from here to there, leading people to a new place, if you will, from a broken place, an exodus to a new place, to the promised land, jokingly. So that the people leadership part comes with it. It's more of an afterthought of when you're actually solving the problem or while you're solving the problem. But I think there's some nuggets there that I've learned firsthand and through a lot of study on this topic. And one is, you know, people, right, they want to cling to here. Even if here is actually really bad, it's still known. And so there's this natural inclination to cling. And I say things like, humorous things like, well, okay, let's see, how much do we work? Let's say we start work at age, we'll round it up, you know, 20s, and let's say we retire at 65. That's 45 years of work. That's a long time to watch the clock and experience a very broken, right, process and have to carry out a broken process. But say, one, we're already here, right? We're already working. And so we might as well do a couple things. We might as well have fun at what we do. Now, that doesn't mean eat cupcakes all day. We have customers to serve and a job to do. But we might as well joke around and have good teamwork and get to know each other. And we also might as well try to solve these problems, because we can deal with them for like 45 years, but we can actually try to solve them, right? So and if we don't solve them, well, then we've got already what we have today. We have a broken process. So I think sometimes that opens people's eyes to, right, I'm already here. Yeah, that seems to make sense. Well, let's give it a shot. So if I fail, I already got what I got now. And so there's really a no ruse there. And so I think that starts, and then the other part of that nugget is we often want to talk about how great things are. So leadership teams may ponder on something for a year or two, and they'll finally figure out a great solution, usually, right? But they forget to realize that employees or the people they're leading haven't been involved in any of those discussions. So you want to start those discussions early. Say, hey, we recognize this is a problem. We're talking about it. If you don't bring them with you on that journey, people will never go to a new place unless they detach from the old place first. So we're often so excited. Hey, we've talked about this 2 years now. We know this is the first time you're hearing about it, but here's paradise. And we want you to go there with us today. You ready? And employees are like, you haven't convinced me to leave the old place. You haven't told me why we want to leave it, and so forth. So we have to get them to detach. And so that's the start of the problem solving or the transformational leadership process.
And one thing I do find interesting, you talk about having discussed it, you know, in some room off somewhere with people nobody knows, and then spring it on them. Here's what we're going to do. And even many times in organizations, when people ask employees their opinions, it's like, okay, write it down on this slip of paper, and then they feel like the slip of paper goes directly to the trash can. What is it that you can do with employees to let them know that their opinion really is valuable?
Yeah, I call it the models of leadership, and there's an 80-20 model, and there's a 20-80 model. Now you have to be a secure leader and a competent leader and to be able to do this, because some leaders aren't. Some leaders are more directors, right? And they just tell people what to do, and they say, well, I'm not sure that's really leadership. You can order them around because you have authority. But if you're really interested in getting people's buy-in and inspiration, the 80-20 part is that. So the normal way of leading change or leading to something new, a new product line or whatever it may be, a healthcare transformation, it doesn't matter what you're leading, but you'd say 20-80. Well, we'll spend 20% of the time planning and so forth, and usually within just the management ranks, and then we'll implement the change at that point, and then we'll spend 80% of our time probably dealing with a mess, right? All the pushback from the change, hey, if you would have asked me, I could have told you this wouldn't work. You could have tweaked it. 80% cleaning up the mess, trying to repair trust, et cetera. If we look at the 80-20 model, we spend 80%. We say, as soon as management starts talking about it, managers and leaders start sharing with employees. They say, we've recognized healthcare is an issue. We want to let you know we're going to start looking into it. We'd love your ideas. We'd love your experiences. We'd love your input. And you spend 80% of the time with everyone as possible involved. And by the time, and then you make a decision after the 80%, and the 20% is the implementation. But everyone's already aware and they've already had a chance to give input. It doesn't mean you go with everyone's idea. That's not possible. But they've given input. And so it's not a surprise. And they're much more likely to accept the change. They're much more likely to support the change. And I can tell you, those two models, one of those changes, the 80-20 goes, or the 20-80 goes very poorly, and the 80-20, if led well, can go quite smoothly.
That sounds like something that we can use in our personal lives as well. I think everybody gets kind of tired of it when somebody just gives some sort of dictate. And you feel like, well, I didn't have any input, and I didn't help think this out. And sometimes, amazingly, that even though you think you don't know anything about a topic, just talking it out makes the person who's the so-called expert see something from an angle that they never saw before. That's the great thing about talking to people.
Yeah, if managers think they had all the answers, then they're fooling themselves, right? Because in that process, one, you get buy-in, but you also get better ideas. I could count 100 times plus where I've actually talked to people and they've given me an idea. I'm like, I didn't think of that. That is really good. Thank you. So they feel valued. They go home feeling valued. And guess what happens when the change comes? You think they accept it or push back?
Exactly. And even one of their coworkers who didn't open their mouth, when they're able to tell the coworker, well, I gave him that idea and he listened, that perks up that coworker for maybe the next project.
Yeah, it makes the next one a whole lot easier, doesn't it? You don't get the flavor of the month thing going, and it makes the, so you build trust. You're essentially building trust. And the other part is really just about it is possible, right? Or at least we're going to try and we're going to try together. I think most people, they for some reason just don't think that kind of transformational change is possible. You hear Billy Graham used to tell stories about he was told that he didn't have what it takes in school. Right?
Oh, so what if
you would have listened to that? So there's all sorts of naysayers out there that for some reason it's safer for them or pessimistic in their mindset, but they just don't believe those things are possible. And often even the first couple of years can be a little rough as not everybody jumps on board. But once you start to experience success, look out. Not only will they jump on board, they'll actually claim they were with you the whole time. It's kind of humorous, and that's fine.
Oh, of course. What did John F. Kennedy say? Success has many fathers. Failure is an orphan.
I've heard that. That's amazing. I love it.
So true. Well, Matt, we have learned so much from you today, and I just urge everybody, remember, speak up. We always have more power than we think we have, and you have it, use it. And as long as you're polite when you speak up, nothing's going to happen to you. Nobody can fire you for giving a suggestion. So think about it, and you have backup. And say the name of your book again, Matt.
Yeah, it's on Amazon, and if someone wants to buy in bulk, they can message me directly at a better rate. It's called Save Your Company, Don't Feed the Beast, the Employer Healthcare Success Formula. They can also Google my name, which is Matt, and the last name is O-H-R-T.
Okay, so everybody listen up, and if you're in a position to do so, which most of us are, talk to your employer. And remember, everybody who's listening, each patient carries his own doctor inside him, and we are at our best when we give that doctor who resides in us a chance to work. So says Dr. Albert Schweitzer. So says Dr. Marilyn Singleton. Thank you for listening.